Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Pete and I are having another walk along the towpaths of Wolverhampton. It's a wonderful early summer day and the birds are in fine voice this morning. And we want to continue our Lao Tzu series. We're going to do chapter 9 and 10 of the Tao Te Ching. So Pete's going to read out chapter 9 and then we're going to have a chat about it and then we'll move on to chapter 10.
Chapter 9. Hold yourself back from filling yourself up, or you'll tip off your stand. You can hammer a blade until it rises sharp, and in seconds it can blunt. You may amass gold and jade in plenty, but then the more you have, the less safety. Are you strutting your wealth like a peacock? Then you've set yourself up to be shot. You bring about your own disaster because you've got too much. Let go when your work is done. That is the way of heaven.
As we were discussing before, Lao Tzu is not recommending that we all live in poverty here. That's not the way of heaven, particularly.
Now, what this is about is it's advice. You know, it's advice on one's contemplative, meditational direction. You know, Lao Tzu is about teaching people how to meditate, and in a particular fashion. But he's also relating that meditation to practicalities of life,
yeah,
and also to politics, to questions of social organisation.
Which he does all the way through.
He does all the way through, and in this he's
like links it all together.
In this he's where he's like Socrates. So what is the advice in this chapter? And what it is, it's a kind of it's a quietism. He recommends quietism of being quiet and mostly unperturbed in one's soul, you might say. You know, and again, it's a bit like the Greek ataraxia. You know, the Stoics liked a kind of a quietness of your inner disposition, you might say. Or you want to use a word loosely, your soul. You know, quietness in your soul. And what he's saying as well is that extremes are unsustainable, you know, in oneself.
Mm.
Unsustainable, and he's trying to help us to be sustainable by not being too entangled up in the games of ego. And actually, you know, he's recommending that we follow the Tao. You know, the great organising principle of the universe, which creates, sustains and destroys moment to moment, as well as being pre-existent before everything and post-existent after everything. And he's saying this is our model. You know, the Tao does a pretty good job on the universe. Look at it, isn't it amazing? So well, let us have a go at utilising our own quota of the Tao. You know, I'm going to call that the human Tao. So that's the scenario here. I mean, look, we can sort of get down to a bit of detail. So the first line, you know, hold yourself back from filling yourself up or you'll tip off your stand. We have a proverb for it, don't we? We have, in England, we have a proverb for, you know, setting yourself up for a fall.
Yeah.
If you blow yourself up, blow your trumpet.
Yeah.
Get too famous, too narcissistically full of yourself. And you climb up onto a stand or a throne or a pulpit and make this huge display. You're setting yourself up for a fall. Yeah. In fact, there's a whole kind of profession dedicated to, certainly in the UK and in the US, you know, the whole profession dedicated to knocking people off perches, you know. Just been watching like Jeremy Paxman have a go at Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May in some kind of televised...
I must say, we were quite disgusted with Paxman.
Oh, yeah.
His really awful, rude behaviour.
Well, don't let anybody anybody speak. And his job is to, is, well, he thinks is to puncture any pretensions, you know. So, you know, this is that scenario. And Lao Tzu is just counselling against it, you know. He's telling, he's saying, well, you want to live, and if you're going to tune with the Tao, you're going to probably want to just be a bit quiet, you know, and there's a lot to be said for it. It's rather flavoursome. And the whole kind of project of celebrity, of the acquisition of the power to gain attention from others, you know, having 10 million likes for your Facebook post, you know, or 10 million followers on Twitter, you know, all these kind of currency of the modern world, which as is one of its central value claims. Is that it's good to acquire more and more and more stuff, including reputation, including likes, including fame. That in our context has turned into a game of bread and circuses, whereby celebrities are built up and allowed to inflate, and then popped and disgraced or traduced in some way in order to provide the public with the cruel spectacle of the downfall. That too says, just don't go there in the fucking first place. How empty, how shallow. Yeah, and it's just, yeah. Five centuries before the common era, the guy's warning us, you know.
Yeah, about consumerism.
Yeah, and of course
about being, well, you know, yeah, not just having things, but being actually being seduced by the things.
Yeah.
Or what you think the things, yeah, represent about yourself. Yeah. And the image that you project, yeah, into the, yeah, world, because, yeah, you have these things, the, yeah, car, the clothes, the whatever, yeah, you know.
Yeah, and they're all about projecting the image and you know, as he says it, you know, filling yourself up. This is just hold back from that.
Yeah.
It is an easy temptation, and it's really unfortunate, I think, that our society and our culture has placed it centre stage, you know. It's so fucking shallow. It's placed acquisitiveness centre stage, you know, and attention. Remember Lao Tzu wandered off through the Western Gate, you know, for solitude. You know, he didn't want it. He had the disposition to see through it and then to not want it. Anyway, that's just the first couple of lines. You see, this stuff, it's very pregnant, isn't it? It's absolutely kind of chockery layers of meaning.
Very relevant for our day and age still.
I think so. I think so. That's just a point that Alan Watts made in his last book, you know, Tao, the Watercourse Way.
Yeah.
Which is, I have to say, is very, very luminous on these matters, and Watts kind of tries to apply it to current existential dilemmas and political and cultural, mistakes, I suppose he thinks they are, you know. Anyway, further on, you can hammer a blade until its razor sharp, and in seconds it can blunt. Yes, but don't sharpen your blade too sharp. Don't be too sharp. Don't be too blunt either. Don't be too sharp. It's like a middle way as well.
Okay. Do you think he's talking also there about how you can work very, very, very hard to get what you want, and you're very, very focused on the acquisition, yeah, of something, but, yeah, then suddenly it can, yeah, next day, I don't know, there could be, yeah, a volcanic eruption and it's all gone, yeah, or a tidal, yeah, wave and it's all gone, or somebody dies and it's all, yeah, gone.
Extremes are not sustainable. This is the message here, you know.
Yeah.
Extremes of wealth are not sustainable. Certainly, extremes of unequal distribution of wealth and power.
Or extremes of security, you think, yeah, like, you've worked so hard for this extreme security where you, yeah, think everything's like done and dusted and you've, yeah, got everything you need and that's, yeah, it. But it can just, yeah, be poof, gone.
Yeah. Oh, well, and then you have a pain in your gut. You go and see the doctor and he says you've got 6 months to live.
Yeah.
And you never know. Yeah, and it is a kind of a middle way teaching this, you know, rather like the Buddhas, you know, and Socrates with his city of pigs, you know. Again, it's not extremes, you know. It's a sort of there is a deep valuing of balance, I think, in Lao Tzu. And the same point about, you know, a blade is made in the famous Changso story of the cutting up of the ox. You know, the butcher who can skillfully cut up an ox in a way that's so skillful that it's awe-inspiring. Actually says that he's only sharpened his cleaver twice in 20 years or something, you know. So you don't need to be too sharp. Just as sharp as you need. You have a sharpening and the blade will chip and, you know, and it'll be blunt straight away. So just get things just right, you know, and stop aspiring to the extreme.
Yeah, you know, because it becomes like a striving anxiety.
It is precisely that, an anxiety.
And
you become
very, very goal orientated, which has its own problems.
Yeah. And I mean, he's even more blunt in the next bit. He says, you know, you may amass gold and jade in plenty, but the more you have, the less safety. And I mean, he says it elsewhere, you know, he's setting himself up to be robbed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You're setting yourself up to be robbed.
Oh. We're just pausing to admire the ducklings. They are absolutely gorgeous and there's loads of them at the canal.
They're here with their mother.
They're really thriving, the ducks. There is few things more delightful in life than a duckling.
Yeah, these are about 2 weeks old now, actually. Look.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah, I think we're going to feed them, don't they?
I think they do. They didn't bring anything now, unfortunately. No. But there's plenty, it's very bountiful down here.
They're doing really well.
Anyway.
You set yourself up with gold and jade and plenty and you're going to be robbed, you know.
Yeah.
And what is it? You know, the richer you, when you get really rich, you have to go into a gated community, you know, with a guard on the gate and a password to get in.
Yeah.
And you've got surveillance cameras everywhere and, you know.
Yeah.
You're not over wealthy, you probably don't even bother to lock your door, you know.
Yeah.
And okay, the burglars come and then they look through your window and there's nothing in the room. So they go away. I mean, in our street, which is sort of, it's populated by sort of quite well-off middle class, I suppose, you know. There's lawyers and doctors and people who earn quite well. They're not like uber-rich, but it's wealthy in comparison, you know. And of course, we got nowt. And there was a period a few years ago when everybody just got burgled all the time. You know, there was a burglary every single day. You ask anybody, I got burgled. And we didn't. Because we'd got downstairs rooms with nothing in them. Yeah, just a carpet, so you can do yoga, nothing. And so they even caught guys looking through the window, you know, shifty looking guys. So, well, anything here? Come in, you know.
And if they looked in the kitchen, which is basically just full of hippie tat.
Yeah.
Which says,
there's nothing worth
this
more.
This is hippie tat, and we don't have anything worth anything, really.
Yeah. You know, and you can see, it's obvious how it works, you know, and I mean, our nation is wealthy, you know, it belongs to the Western, educated, democratic, wealthy, blah, blah, you know, scenario. What is the biggest political crisis around? It's around security. Yeah. It's around people willingness ill. Out of resentment at how much fucking shit we've got, you know, and that's how the whole industry arises, to protect all that. And eventually it will, that kind of thing turns a society into a nightmare.
Yeah.
And he hits the head right on the nail right on the head with that.
Yeah.
He hits the nail right on the head with that.
Yeah.
All out, sir. And then he goes and he says, are you strutting your wealth like a peacock? You just set yourself up to be shot. Well, you know, it happens. It really, really happens. Yeah. You bring about your own disaster because you've got too much. So he's in favour of, I mean, he doesn't recommend poverty. Actually, you know, when Lao Tzu describes ideal conditions of life, he describes that kind of simple, satisfying prosperity that Socrates describes in the City of Pigs. I mean, the City of Pigs isn't a place where people endure the misery of poverty. You know, they've got plenty because they've got good land and they till it and they look after it. And he says he sits there in the sun, deriving great pleasure from watching his grandchildren play in the dust. You know, no greater pleasure. These are good lives. It's a good life. You know. And he says, let go when your work is done. I mean, again, this is not, you know, doing what you've got to do. Creating things. Hopefully putting energy into trying to make the world a better place and to helping people. But then forget it, you know. It's just like a non-acquisitiveness of what you might loosely call like the fruits of labour, you know. Don't be acquisitive about it. Just do it because it's what you do. Mm-hmm. And it's a recommendation for sure. And he says that is the way of heaven.
Yeah.
You know, it's utopian. And I think the analysis is correct. That having a central value in a society of acquisitiveness
is not the path of heaven. It's not happiness.
No. It's not sustainable, as we are now finding out. And having our noses rubbed in that on every possible level.
Yeah.
Ecological, financial, monetary, cultural. Everything, the whole thing's bankrupt. And there, it takes a bloke from 2,500 years ago to point out just why, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll go on to chapter 10, which continues in the same vein of relating individual alignment with the Tao, which is called meditation or contemplation, and relating that into some kind of political scenario through the idea of the sage. And Lao Tzu starts off posing a few questions. You know, this, of course, is a time-honoured instructional a method of good meditation teachers. So chapter 10, can you nurture your souls by holding them in unity with the One? Can you focus your chi, your energy, and become as supple as yielding as a baby? Can you clear your mind of all its dross without throwing out the Tao with it? Can you do it without self-interest, so you shine like a diamond? Can you love the people of your nation without being pulled into action? Can you turn yourself around and let her rise up over you? The world spans out in four directions. And can you be as embracing, birthing, nurturing and sustaining? The Tao does this unceasingly. It gives without holding on to what it's made. It gives everything essence without reward. It knows without flaunting it. It is serene beyond desiring. And this is its virtue and its source. So once again, Lao Tzu is saying, well, the meditation is to align with the Tao, and here are its qualities. You have a go at being the same.
Yeah.
You know. So if there is any, you know, it's very much a non-doing in meditation, about sinking into the heart, you know, but we never avoid doing, because even non-doing is doing non-doing, you know. Actually, we can't avoid either non-doing or doing. So Lao Tzu, you know, he's having a little push on the doing side there, and of course, but making it very, very open and loose. You know, what it requires of us is suppleness. You know, not just suppleness of our bones and our muscles and our tendons, suppleness of the body, but suppleness of the mind and the feeling faculties as well.
Yeah.
And to kind of to nudge us in the direction of aligning with the Tao, he asks us these questions here. Can you nurture your souls by holding them in unity with the One? Well, he's asking you, he's not saying try to, he's just saying can you?
Yeah.
And so you can inquire into yourself, well, can I? Determine that by self-inquiry, and you can.
What do you think he means by the word nurturing there?
Which self-care, on the individual level, how can we care for ourselves? How do we look after ourselves?
So it's not talking about cultivation.
It's not cultivation in the sense of like this fierce, painful, ascetic, austere attempt to remodel oneself according to a moralistic ideal. He's not doing that. Because the Dewi's kind of amoral. He's rather recommending alignment with the Dao. The air is the most inspiring and efficient creative principle in the universe. You contain it, and it contains you. You are part of it. It is part of you. So, what makes the most sense? Conforming to a man-made ideal, or conforming to the most efficient principle in existence? And then, you know, can you focus your chi, your energy, become as supple and yielding as a baby? This is a fairly kind of concrete discipline, is qigong, and energy regulation. But again, this isn't done by forcing an ascetic discipline. It's done by inquiry and allowing. See, he's asking us the question. He isn't saying go away and cultivate your Tao like this, this and this. He's saying find out if you can. Because in that attempt to find out if you can, it's then that the processes, the transformative processes happen. Out of the question.
Yeah.
Not out of the effort to be different. And but the result, he tells you, you'll be supple and as yielding as a baby. And then, you know, a suppleness of the soul, this is what the Dao is very supple. The Dao is supple, it doesn't hang on to what it produces. It never ceases to produce, to give birth, to nurture, etc. It never ceases to do that. But the minute it's done, it's on the next thing. It's forgot. Yeah. And it's not attached to the results of its work.
Yeah.
It's not acquisitive. Can you clear your mind of all this dross without throwing the Dao out with it? I mean, clearing dross, I suppose, is a kind of scepticism that directs itself to one's beliefs and orientations. And he's asking us, can we? Well, of course, you have to question the value of what you believe and what you think and what your mental processes are like and what your emotional processes are like. Just by being self-aware. Gently self-aware. Supply self-aware. And look, you do find, I think, just in that openness to oneself and one's character, you do, without being hypercritical, driven by superego and guilt and horrible notions of self-cultivation, one can discover that, well, there is a lot of crap. And from that, you learn then the value of travelling light, which we've talked about in a podcast. There's a podcast called Travelling Light.
Yeah.
Talks about this. But don't chuck the Dao out at the same time. It's like scepticism, because there is a certain scepticism involved in this clear looking at self. But it can be corrosive to your apprehension of the Dao within you. It can't kill the Dao within you because it's essential to you. But it can make you, qua ego, sceptical towards it as an idea. And so we'll be careful of that. Just be a bit careful of that. And I think it's right, again. And he goes on, can you do it without self-interest as you shine like a diamond?
Yeah. A crazy diamond.
You will shine like a crazy diamond, but don't make anything of it. You know, against the acquisitive, it's the anti-acquisitive thing. It's the advice against acquisitiveness.
Like shine like a diamond because you do actually just enjoy shining.
Yeah, well, you are a diamond, so shine. You know, and diamonds shine, but there's no self-consciousness to it. Is what is giving out here, you know.
And you don't need anyone to see you shine.
No.
Or to reflect back your shine.
No.
You're just shining because do.
That's jumping onto the perch and waiting to be knocked off, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's only intelligent, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Can you love the people of your nation without being pulled into action? Well, this is where Lao Tzu is extrapolating the Dao-orientated individual into the sage who has some kind of leadership responsibilities in a society. But he's saying, can you have a light touch with that as well? He said, again, jumping up, making a big clatter of drums and trumpets and noise and fanfare as you lead the nation off to war with this huge grandiosity. Yeah, so avoid that. Again, the quietness, the light touch. This is what he's pointing to, you know. He says, and it's advice to would-be leaders. Yeah. Be a sage first, then be a leader, and lead quietly like a sage. Can you turn yourself around and let her rise up over you?
We had a bit of debate this morning over what that little phrase meant, didn't we?
Yeah, and he puts her in with a capital H.
Yes.
And I think he means like the mother, which is like this big nurturing aspect of the Tao. You know, the Tao is the mother of everything. And can you, in a sense, he's pointing out that the Tao is bigger than your individuality. Certainly kind of outshines and outclasses and outranks ego by a millionfold. And he's saying, well, can you let yourself be absorbed in it? Can you let it overwhelm you? And there is a sort of an overwhelming that can happen in these quietest meditations. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know? And he's talking about that. Well, can you do it? Are you going to shit your pants? Or are you going to relax down and let it happen?
But you could do both.
Yeah. Well, chances are, first time you will.
You'll
shit your pants, and then you think, okay, I'm going to have another go, and this time I'm going to just... Whew, that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
And now you can just go quietly with it, and the light touch and the quietness again.
Yeah.
Then he goes on, and this bit I found very pregnant. The world spans out in four directions, and can you be as embracing? This is something I've been kind of thinking about a lot lately, just in the attempt to understand the sort of political argy-bargy in the modern world. And I'm coming down on the side of thinking that there is a very core question about people's political orientation around the extent to which one is willing to extend one's sympathies and empathies. Yeah. And I think conservatism as an underpin, you know, small c, large c, as an underpinning evaluation of our capabilities of extending empathy has been sort of fairly limited. I mean, it just stuck in my mind hearing Enoch Pell say that 40 years ago. I mean, this arch rightist. He said in a poem something, I love the man who loves his own. And he thought that we weren't actually capable of extending our sympathies much further than the family or the village. Maybe with a bit of work, we can extend it to the nation. And patriotism, you know, we can produce patriotism. But beyond that, we're really just not capable. And that we should be realistic about that. And I think that underpins conservatism, you know, especially when it gets mixed up with nationalism. Of course, historically, conservatism wasn't mixed up with nationalism. The earliest Tories, way back in the 18th century, thought that nationalism was disgraceful, mm-hmm. and it was a voice of the working class. Mm-hmm. But of course, it got marshalled as the franchise increased, you know, and in the 18 the Great Reform Act 1830, whatever, widened the franchise. So there was then the need to capture the attention of, well, at least working men with property, you know. So, and as the franchise widened historically, conservatism took on more nationalism. But I mean, Lao Tzu seems to be saying, you know, well, widen your sympathies as far as you can, but you know, find out if you can. Is this conservative idea that we're very limited true or not?
And it is in our opinion, and that we both share, is that it's perfectly possible for your sympathies to extend to the globally, and to care about people who are being bombed in other countries.
In distant lands, yeah.
And their children and their families. Not just the people of our own family or our own country.
Yeah.
And what will happen if we can't extend our sympathies to the rest of the world is that we're probably all doomed.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, we should certainly ask the question. You know, we should certainly ask the question. And the question isn't being posed. A certain answer to that question underpins rightism, and a certain answer to that question underpins leftism. You know, and you could put it down to like conservatism versus progressivism as broad categories. But Lao Tzu brings that question right out into the fore, and you know, I'm having like thoughts about our modern political situation, whereby it's seeming more and more day by day to me that this is a very, very crucial and underpinning question, and the individuals need to know where they stand on that, and to actually make the arguments, and to be realistic. I think the Conservative play for realism in this direction. It has to be taken account of. That is what they actually give to this debate that seems positive to me. And they say, well, be realistic. I mean, it can be terribly hard looking after one sick relative. And you can have all sort of grandiose notions about saving the starving children in Africa, but you can be severely challenged by looking after one sick relative.
Yeah. But in that instance, you know, one cannot be all things to all men.
No.
And you can only do what you can do and what your energy allows you to do.
Well, this is why Lao Tzu doesn't say extend your sympathies to all beings. He says, can you?
Yeah.
Can you?
I mean, just to
say how clever that is.
Yeah.
Is as our meditation instructor giving us a question rather than an answer or an ought to.
Yeah.
But as you're saying, we've kind of been thinking about this lately, and we think you should at least have a go.
Yeah.
There's not much future for a human race that adopts very narrow affinities.
No.
And there's an enormous amount of political effort, it seems to me, going into persuading us that we can't.
Yeah.
That we should narrow down, not expand, but narrow down.
Yeah.
You know, since you've got like, you know, emboldened by Trump, for instance, the election of Trump, you've got, you know, attempts to sunder men from women, and to sunder peoples on the basis of the colour of their skin or their ethnic origins or their sexual orientation, to sunder people, when so much work has been done to overcome this.
Yeah.
And it's happening all over the place.
Yeah.
It's happening all over the place. It's happening in the yoga community. And it is down to the question of one's affinities, empathies, sympathies, and how far do they go? Now, obviously, if you're the kind of person that wants to jump on the stage, you're shallowly entranced with fame or acquisition of objects, that you will have narrow sympathies. These two go together, you know.
Yeah.
And some kind of alignment with the Tao gives you the suppleness of being and the energy to have a go, and the conviction that you would need to at least have a go without holding us up to an impossible council of perfection at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is why Lao Tzu phrases this as a question. He knows that we're real.
Yeah.
And that we struggle.
Yeah. But to see ourselves as not just a nation, but as a global community, and to extend our sympathies in all directions, it's like really, as long as that is
actualized.
As long as that is actualized in a very a practical and sensible way, there's no downside to it, really, is there?
There's no downside. There's certainly no downside to at least having a go,
no.
At least exploring within yourself how you actually feel about all this stuff. You know, what are my kind of root feelings here?
Yeah.
Is another thing to.
And what part of yourself do you have to turn off to not care about? A city that's just had a nuclear bomb dropped on it.
Precisely.
You know, it, even if it is in the most distant country from your own, what's going on inside you if you can't bring any sympathy for that, or any empathy inside yourself.
So then Lao Tzu returns to the Tao as the exemplar, or the Tao as the nature of the Tao as being that which holds all the clues to our meditation, to our embeddedness in these questions in our meditation. And the Tao is the paradigm, you know. And he says, birthing, nurturing, sustaining, the Tao does this unceasingly. So it does. And it's like the sage, because being the sage isn't an act, but just an expression of his of an individual's root nature, does exactly the same thing, without ceasing. Till they die. It gives without holding on to what it's made, again. You know, the recommendation that we abandon acquisitiveness, just like the Tao. It gives everything essence without reward. We do the same, you know, we do our work, we're not too worried about the reward. Just like the Tao. Yeah. It knows without flaunting it. Again, there's the quietness, there's the pointing out of the danger of too much swank. I mean, I would say, have a bit of swank, you know, but don't overdo it, you know. Have the nature of a dervish, then wear a stylish hat. It knows without flaunting it. It is serene beyond desiring. Again, you know, the image of the sages of this very, very quiet contemplator of nature is very, very easeful and supple as a baby. And this is its virtue and its source. Well, be like that, eh? Be like that, chaps.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the walk then. So I hope that was entertaining and useful for you all. I wish you could all be here because it's very beautiful down the canal at the moment, even though it is in the heart of the Black Country in Wolverhampton. It still is it's quite verdant.
It is, the flowers. Look at these dog roses hanging over this wire fence.
Yeah, there's like blossom and flowers and ducklings.
And there's some kind of industrial shit on the other side there, but there's this great bank of roses.
Yeah.
Wild roses.
And amazing.
All manner of white flowery things.
Yeah. So, even though you can't be here, we've done our best to give you a little sketch of what we're walking through. So, we will speak to you again soon.